Welcome to Burning the Ships podcast, and I'm your host, Jason Seward. And today I got my buddy Lauren Wernette on the show. And before I get into Lauren's intro, I'm going to do JJ's joke of the week. Here it goes. What is a snake's favorite school subject? History. And that is JJ's joke of the week. Now, when he asked me, or told me that joke, my answer was science. And it could have been social studies or anything like that. But he was adamant that the right answer is history, because snakes hiss at you. So that's JJ's joke of the week. But now on to Lauren Wernette. Lauren is, as are a lot of my guests, a good example of the power of social media as a networking tool. So Lauren's another one that we connected through social media. And he's down in North Carolina, and he's also a lender as well. He does a little bit offers a different type of product than we offer at 608B Capital, but a lot of similarities as well. He's set up as a fund, as are we. He's just lending on some different types of risk than we do, and he'll go into all that in the episode. But what fascinates me about Lauren, the more I've gotten to know him, is first of all, I think he connected with me after seeing some of the stuff that we put on social media, reached out, and we had a good phone call, just kind of comparing notes on what we're both doing in the real estate industry. I don't want to steal his thunder, because he'll go through all his stories. So he's got a fascinating story. But one thing that through the conversations, we had a couple conversations. He invited me on his podcast, which is Brick by Brick. If any of you want to look that up and either see my episode or any of his prior episodes or future episodes. But we had a lot of similarities. One being that we were both fathers and husbands, and that those two titles are the two titles that we both hold, you know, the most priority. We put the most priority into is those two titles, husband and father, and he certainly does as well, and he'll talk about that a good bit. Another thing about Lauren that, you know, the more we've gotten to know each other, and he'll talk about it in the episode, but y'all have heard me talk and Bill talk about our workout streaks, where we've gone a certain amount of days in a row where we haven't missed a workout. Lauren has. For Bill and I, there was nothing more than just pride and competition to do that, right? It was a way for us to kind of add in some accountability for ourselves to just stay in shape and stay healthy. But we were already kind of doing that anyway. We were both relatively healthy, and we just added this challenge in as another layer of that. Well, in Lauren's case, he had a little bit of a health scare, and he'll touch on that in the episode. And it was kind of a light bulb moment to him, you know, with the young children and the family and all that stuff. Everything that he wanted to do in life and had dreams of doing with his family, he had a little bit of a health scare that kind of shook him up and made him realize that he needed to make some changes. So at that point, he has gone on a mega health journey, has completely changed his nutritional and exercise habits. Has lost a lot of weight, gotten in very good overall health, and continues on that journey. I'll let him kind of talk more about it in the interview, but the theme of this podcast being burning the ships. Well, that's just one example of Lauren having kind of a light bulb moment and deciding to burn the ship on his old self and his old habits when it came to health and nutrition and rebuild new ones. And he has stayed the course and continues to do so. I love having conversations like that with people. So yes, we're connected in real estate and entrepreneurship and all these other things, but to see him and hear him light up when he starts talking about his kids and his family and, you know, the things outside of all the business stuff really, really connected me to him. So I was very excited to have him on here. I think you guys will enjoy this conversation. And with that, I'll turn it over to my talk with Lauren Wernette. Welcome to Burning the Ships podcast. Today, I've got my man, Lauren Wernette. Lauren, welcome to the podcast, my man.
What's going on, Jason? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. I'm excited. I got to do yours. Been a couple weeks ago now, or maybe a month or so ago. And what I loved about that conversation, you and I had spent a little bit of time on the phone, kind of more business talk than personal talk, but that podcast went in a direction which I liked, and we really got diving into mindset and things like that, and our families and, you know, health and all that stuff. So we're going to kind of continue that conversation, but I love getting to know people kind of with my audience, right? And I got to do that on your podcast, got to know more about you and share my story. But now I get to turn all that over to you and let you share your story with our audience. So with that, I'm going to start things off with turning it over to you and just letting you kind of at a high level, any direction you want to go, but tell the folks who you are, where you are, and what you got going on, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So thanks for having me on. First, I just want to say that, you know, this podcast format is really fun, because what other atmosphere do you get to like just sit and talk about each other's background and experience? Most phone calls are, you know, very transactional about what you can do for me or what I can do for you. And so the podcast is a really nice way of just kind of meeting somebody and getting to know a little bit about what makes them tick. So anyway, Lauren Wernette. So I'm a North Carolina resident. I am a hard money lender, similar to you, although we have a different product than what you guys offer. Prior to starting the hard money lending business, I had about 65 rentals in North Carolina, did about 20 flips. And before that, I was a W-2 employee. So I'm a converted or a saved W-2 employee. Left my W-2 last year in about August and have been going full time on the hard money lending business ever since. And the important stuff, so dad of four, my wife and I have been married 13 years ago yesterday, and we've been in North Carolina for about 8 years. Love it. And as my wife says, we're never moving back to the frozen tundra of Michigan again.
So originally from Michigan.
Originally from Michigan, grew up on a beef cattle farm. Actually, interesting, I grew up in beef cattle, worked for a crop consulting company from the time I was 16 until all the way through my master's. And then was a junior partner in that company. We were basically looking at potato fields on a weekly basis and then giving recommendations to the farmers about what they should do to improve their crop. And then when my wife got pregnant with our first child, I decided that I didn't want to work 7 days a week, 14-hour days from May until September anymore.
Why not?
And so, yeah, it was great when I was 16, 17, right? Not so good when I was in my mid-20s and had a wife and a new son on the way, wanted to actually be part of his life. And so somebody that I was in a fraternity with in Michigan State said, hey, I've got a job in the company that I work for. I'm moving out of that role. You should come work with me. So I moved into sales, which was a big transition, going from consulting to sales. And then went from that, did that for several years, managed a $5.5 million territory covering eastern half of North Carolina, of Michigan. And then our company moved me to North Carolina into the marketing department, where I did 2.5-3 years stint there, and then moved into digital project management, rolling out Salesforce Commerce Cloud and Service Cloud across North America. And then COVID hit. And my whole paradigm of ladder climber, move up, VP, you know, trajectory just got shattered. I didn't want to, you know, ask for my vacation time the rest of my life. I wanted to have something more long term that I was building for my family. I wanted to set a good example for my kids. And so I started down the real estate path. And so my entire real estate portfolio started with an idea in 2020. And then led to 66 properties being purchased by basically the end of 23.
All right. So I made a lot of notes here. I'm gonna go back a little bit to kind of fill in some gaps. So you said when you went into that sales career, what were you selling? What product or service were you selling?
Yeah, so still in agriculture. So the company I worked for was selling herbicides, insecticides, those type of things for farmers. And so I was working in eastern Michigan, where there's a lot of sugar beets, dry beans, and things like that. And selling ag chemical. And the great thing about that job is I had about a 45,000 T&E or time and expense budget. So we went on trips up to Canada fishing. We went down to the Bahamas to go fishing. We went hunting. It was awesome. I sometimes I wonder why I left that role.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if I shared this with you, but I worked in an ag related field. I was in insurance, but the bulk of my clientele were farmers, and I'm in a rural market. But so I was very familiar with I'm in Virginia, you're just south of us, but soybeans, cotton, peanuts and corn and all that. But the main product I sold was crop insurance. So, I was tied to that. And I loved the ag industry, right? I just didn't necessarily like working for a company, right? So, but I loved my customers. I loved what I did on a daily basis for the most part. To your point, over time you realize like you got to ask permission for everything, right? I mean, that's what it ultimately is. You don't own that business that you're sacrificing so much time on. So you get moved to Carolina, 2020. Did COVID did that ignite the real estate bug?
Yeah. I mean, so when COVID hit, we were doing a lot of hiking at the time. Like our family as a whole hiked 150 miles total over the course of that year. We hit all but 7 of the state parks in North Carolina. And I remember exactly where we were in what park on what trail when it just kind of like hit me like a thundercloud. Like if they could have us 5 days in the week in the office to 5 days a week at home, they could just as easily just send me packing, right, at any point in time. And my career had been growing pretty steadily at that point, but it started to kind of plateau out. And so I either needed to, make some big changes. Like the next step was probably moving to Germany, taking my whole family over there for a delegation, or it was going to be to change companies, because internal promotions are going to give you like 5 to 6% pay increase, maybe 10. And so the only way to get a big pay bump is to change basically whole companies. And I'd already been with the company like 6 years at that point in time. And I had basically start, and I'm very thankful now, but I had a boss at that time that was not very pleasant to work with. And I think that if I had a more pleasant boss, I would have wanted to been worked harder to stay, but he made it uncomfortable for me to be there. And like anybody knows, the more uncomfortable you get, the easier it is to change directions or shift. If you're very comfortable in what you're doing or how you're sitting financially, mentally, anything, it's very hard to get out of that rut and move into something different. And so my life became very uncomfortable having worked with him or for him. And so I said, I need to do something. And so we started first do a Amazon FBA business, create a little bit of money there, but it was never something we wanted to do long-term, and then moved into real estate when one of my friends was doing rentals and basically sold me on the dream of cash flow, which I know is a bold-faced lie now, but.
Well, let's go there. So, at that point in 2020, when you were sold on the dream of cash flow and rentals and all that stuff, did you have any other rentals did you have any other property other than the house you lived in? No.
No. So I actually, we only had the property we lived in. I had up to that point, my wife had always said, hey, maybe we should get some rentals someday, because her family had some rentals in California and some other states. And I had always had an aversion to it, because growing up, my dad had one trailer house that was on a piece of property that they farmed, and he always had renters and had nothing but nightmares there. Yeah. Now, looking back, that I know now, I think he just rented to whoever had a pulse and didn't do any screening, and hence you get bad tenants. So I just had a very bad idea of what owning rentals was going to be. It wasn't until my friend, who had 2 or 3 at that time, said, this is what I'm paying for them, this is what they're, putting out, that I started to head down that path. So it was just kind of multiple little nudges in that direction that finally pushed me over the edge.
Got it. So, and were you doing like the BRRRR strategy, or were you buying turnkey rentals? What was your strategy going into it? And 2-part question, what was the initial strategy? And then where did the scale come from? I mean, you talk about a 3-year period amassing 66 properties, which, my partner and I, we had a similar trajectory. We started a few years prior than you, but I'm curious to know what your strategy and what your scaling strategy was.
Yeah. So the strategy when I started, well, the first one was a seller finance deal. I just kind of fell into that after doing some cold calling. Anyway, so that was the first one. But the idea was basically BRRRR. I was going to find properties in C to maybe D areas. In specific, there's a couple towns that I was looking at that there was a big discrepancy in, you know, the price you could buy for something for and what you could get Section 8 tenants in there for. And so the idea was to basically do BRRRR Section 8 housing in these lower areas. So I did my first one, seller finance. It was a triplex, renovated that whole thing, got it rented out. And about the same time, there was another triplex that came up on the market on the MLS. I had all my cash tied up in that first triplex at that point still, because we hadn't finished the refi. And so I reached out to somebody I met through a local real estate group and said, hey, this is a great deal. You should go buy this. I don't have any cash, but you should go buy this property. And he basically went and looked at the property with me and said, hey, do you want a finder's fee? I said, I don't need a finder's fee. I'm not a believer in transactional relationships. And he said, well, how about I can raise the money, or I can fund it. You can manage it and we'll split the profits 50-50. And so that was the first of a JV. And then that turned into a business with the two of us, where I was basically sourcing deals. He was reaching out to his private lender network and raising capital. And we were able to pair up and really grow very quickly through our kind of shared skills. And then along the way, I obviously built my private lender network as well. And so that made us grow even faster.
Yep. Gotcha. What was your primary source of deals? I'm sure it's a bunch of strategies, but were you dealing with a lot of wholesalers, or were you doing direct to seller marketing?
No, we were probably picking up less than 5% of our deals from direct to seller. I think we were picking up about 12% from the MLS, and the rest was all from wholesalers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but same with us. We pretty much everything we did was wholesalers. We and just like you, I mean, it sounds like you were doing this while you also had a corporate job. So you were, you know, that's where your attention needed to be. So now you're building this portfolio. Sounds like it scaled pretty quickly. So you're month after month picking up new deals and stuff like that. At what point did you start to feel the conflict between that and your corporate job? I'm not so much asking like, when did you start to realize like, hey, there's a path here for me to burn the ships, but when did it become like, oh, I've essentially got two full-time jobs here?
Yeah. I mean, it probably took 6 to 9 months, maybe closer to a year before I really started feeling it. Now, I attribute a lot of our growth to having the corporate job. If all of your time is dedicated to just that one thing, right, you're able to do a lot of things manually because you have the free time. When you have a full-time job plus four kids plus, you know, these businesses on the side, you have to figure out ways to become more efficient. And so there were a lot of things that I figured out how to automate and to create processes and systems around very early on, not because we really needed them at that point in time, but because I had to have them in order to make sure all of the plates kept spinning while also keeping my corporate job going. And that allowed us to basically leap ahead quickly without huge amounts of pain. Like, there wasn't much difference between buying one house a month versus five houses because of the systems and processes we put in place.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. When you're without the need to, you know, if it's not forced, that efficiency is forced like that. We did the same thing. Like my partner and I both have very demanding corporate jobs. There was no hiding from that. Like, we had to do our job daily and focus on our staff and everything like that. So like, it forces efficiency. I guess I'm curious to know if you dealt with this. My challenge became, okay, now I'm putting myself where I have to force efficiency, which for me was block off time outside of the commitment to my corporate job to then focus on the real estate needs, finding deals, underwriting deals, dealing with contractors, banks, all that stuff. That piece of it started taking time away from the family, right? And you mentioned four kids. Talk about that. Did you experience any of that where like, man, this is not sustainable, or I'm putting my family at risk, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the benefits I have is that A, the role I had within that company was much more operational. And so that wasn't a lot of the contractor stuff, which tends to be more in the evenings. And B, I'm a very morning person. And so I was able to get up, like I've been getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning for like the last 7 years. Right. And so getting up at 5 o'clock, I'd get 4 hours of work done, you know, 3 hours of work done before I even started my day job, and then work through lunch on the business. And then I would get done with work around four. And then, you know, you get a couple hours, like an hour or two before dinner. And then if I had to, I could pick up a little bit in the evenings. But after about a year, I basically said, no, I'm going to be done with all work at 6 p.m. So I've got to figure out how I can get all this done by six, because I want to put my kids to bed. I want to see my wife in the evenings. I want to help with dinner. Like, because there's no point in building all of this if I ruin the thing that I'm building it for. And if that means that we grow slower or we don't get as far as we want to go because of that, you know, sacrifice, so be it. I'm not willing to, I personally, and I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with people that do this, but I'm not willing to sacrifice my family and my time with my young kids, you know, for extreme success long term, because the success will come.
100%. And, you know, what I think it's interesting, because you just listed off like the early mornings, you know, you're up 3 hours and getting 3 hours of work in before most people are eating breakfast, right? And you're very disciplined with that time at lunch, and then a little bit of time whenever you have gaps you can fill. You were getting it in, but the family doesn't feel it as much when you're doing it that way. And as you elaborate on your story, there's so many parallels to what we were doing. We were getting up early. We were meeting my partner and I in a Hardee's parking lot when COVID was going on, because we couldn't go inside Hardee's. We were sitting in our truck and underwriting deals, and at lunch we were making offers and things like that. And I get asked, and I'm sure you do all the time, like, how did you guys grow so quickly from basically not much going on in real estate to getting to a point where you left your corporate careers in a matter of 3 to 5 years? Well, nobody saw that behind the scenes work, right? That's a lot of commitment of time to do it in a way where you're not also compromising your family. And it sounds like you did the same thing. And there's your answer. There's a lot of things that happen at dark and while everybody else is sleeping, that it looks like this was an easy path and it happened overnight. But no, it was a lot of commitment, that doing things that a lot of people aren't willing to do.
Yeah. And that's just the plan stuff, right? And I'm sure you probably do this too, but you know, I've got a problem in my head. You know, I'll wake up at 2 a.m, can't sleep. I'll get up and, you know, start working through it. And a lot of our processes and systems were built at like between 2 and 4 a.m, because it's totally quiet. I get an idea in my head and I can't sleep. And so you might as well get up and start, you know, building out an Excel model or building out a workflow or something to improve the business. Cause otherwise I'm just going to lay there, still be tired and not have any accomplished anything.
Right.
And so, yeah, there's probably, if sleep deprivation takes years off your life, which it probably does, I probably lost some years on that, but I wouldn't be where I am if I hadn't made some of those sacrifices.
Yep. So you asked me a question that I thought was interesting, and we had a good conversation around it, but I'm gonna come back to it now. You asked me if I thought entrepreneurs were born or it was learned over time, and you asked if I had always had this mindset of entrepreneurship, and I have. Yes, I worked in a corporate setting for 17 years, but I've always had this mindset. And you went on to say that you necessarily didn't have that mindset. So talk about like that transformation from really not having that mindset, and probably, you know, like you said earlier, if you had a good situation with your boss and an easier situation there, you would have been fine settling in there and just working up the ladder, making your money and retiring like normal. What shifted that? Was it, you know, like, when did you start acquiring more of that mindset, and then, you know, go further with that to the point where you decided like, I can do this on my own and I am going to do it on my own?
So I think me, as in like most people, we are very impacted by the examples that we see around us. You know, so me, for example, I probably should have had more of an entrepreneurial background or experience because my father was an entrepreneur. He had a farm. He still has a farm with my brother in Michigan. But for some reason, like, it was never, I never thought of him as an entrepreneur. He was a farmer, right? It wasn't a job. It was a lifestyle. But when you grow up in rural, any rural area, like a lot of times, what do you see? You see like, oh, there's cops and there's, you know, farmers and there's teachers and there's like a handful of occupations. You don't see a lot of the other occupations. And so growing up, I saw, you know, people that worked in ag, I saw farmers, I knew that there was some career to be made there and just kind of fell into some sort of rhythm of what I saw around me. It wasn't until I moved to North Carolina, got out of where I was growing up, which was nothing wrong with where I was growing up, but started to see other opportunities, right? See that, oh, this person's doing this and that's very interesting. They're working outside of the corporate structure. They're outside of a job. They are the boss, right? You know, the only people that I knew that were the owners of companies that you actually thought of as entrepreneurs were electricians. Like there's like seven electricians in my hometown, right? And so that was what I thought of as entrepreneurs, and I wasn't in the trades. And so then you move to an area, you meet new people, and you realize, oh wow, there's like this whole other area of the world that you've never experienced. And so it was getting kind of that enlightenment of there are opportunities out here that I didn't even know were opportunities. And there was also a switch that happened, had nothing to do with entrepreneurship in my head at some point in like the late teens. And it had more to do with like building stuff. Cause I'm very like building hands-on. And at some point I realized like if someone else built something, there's no reason I couldn't figure out how to build it. Right. And I think too many in our culture today, too many people are like, oh, I'll just go buy that. Right. Which that's fine. You can go buy stuff, but that was built somewhere. And maybe you don't have the right tools, but you can cobble something together and you don't have to buy everything off the shelf. You can usually build stuff. And this led to me brewing my beer. I built some rifles in my day, you know, some all kinds of things that you just think if you go buy, but I built them. And so you take that mentality and then move into business, figure out, okay, how can I get out of this corporate job and realize that it's got to be something that I build myself. And the switch on the entrepreneurship really happened when we started the Amazon FBA business, because it went from corporate mind or, you know, employee mindset to overnight, like everything looked like a opportunity. I think a lot of people can relate to this. They start down that path and there's a billboard. I wonder how much they make per month on that. Wonder what the cost is on that. Oh, I wonder what a pest control company makes. You know, everything looks like an opportunity. And it's a interesting time in someone's life because everything looks like a way to make money. And especially if you don't have much money, like, oh, I could do that and it'll make me $100 a month. You get more mature and you realize like, oh, I'm not worried about $100 a month. I'm worried about how do I make $100,000 a month or something, right? So there's different scopes, but as a new entrepreneur, everything looks like an opportunity. And so that was when I started was, you know, that one little switch of doing that one little business and just opened my eyes to all the different ways people were able to play in the market and make money out of basically nothing or out of just their ideas.
Yeah, I love you articulated that very well because, I mean, that makes sense. You like creating things and you like, I mean, you kind of related it to seeing a billboard or something like that. Oh, how are they making money? But it's not necessarily from what I'm hearing, the money piece of it is how can I do something similar that provides some value that I get some reward from? And that reward could be, most of the time in business, obviously, it is money, but the money is the tool that ultimately gets you what you want. And you alluded to it earlier, time with family, you got four kids, you got a wife, and in order to do the things with them that you want to do and have the time to do it, you've got to build things that allow for that, that give you the tools to do it. So, yeah, that's interesting. Some insight into my brain has always been like that. Like since I was a kid, and it's a blessing in a lot of ways, but it has been a curse as well because I chase everything that pops up in front of me. Like, you know, it's the squirrel type mentality. And I think for personalities like mine, it is very important, and I've been fortunate to do a good job with this, but surrounding myself with people that I trust that can check me, like keep me in check. And like my business partner, my wife, you know, people in my family, friends, they know when I'm chasing too many things. They say, hey, dial it back. And I'm like, you're right. I got to dial it back. But I'm constantly in that state of, you know, this cup right here. Who made that? Somebody's making money off that. Why can't I? That same mindset led me to starting a hard money lending fund, a debt fund, right? Somebody's doing it. I'm borrowing this hard money. They're making money off of it. Why can't I do that? So some of the stuff, again, it's a blessing, but some of it's a curse. So that was a little bit of a tangent there. But my next question has to do with you're building all of this. You're amassing these rentals. You're at some point probably sooner rather than later, you realize that the cash flow was not going to be what you had dreamed it would be, right? You know, every house you buy, the one you bought before that, the heat pump went out. They just wiped out a year's worth of cash flow, right? So I'm sure you experienced that pretty quickly. What point did you start recognizing and having interest in other areas of real estate would ultimately land at you into lending? When did that transition happen?
So I think the thing to know here is that anybody that starts in business is not going to know where they're going to end up in business. It is a journey, and you know, I would have never guessed that I was going to be in hard money lending. So basically, when you get started, you think, okay, what seems interesting? And then once you start doing it, you realize what all the skeletons are about that. I like this part of it, but I hate these things, or I don't, you know, or I can't stand this, that kind of thing. So I am very much the type of person of, what do I want to be doing in 10 years? So after you amass a certain amount of information, you sit down and you kind of reflect, like, do I enjoy what I'm doing? Do I want to be doing this in 10 years? And I'm a firm believer in, instead of just strengthening your weaknesses, which you should be doing, but you should be really playing to your strengths. And so where am I really strong at versus where am I really weak? And is there something I could do that would allow me to do more of the things that I like doing that I'm strong at and less of the things that I'm weak at? Because then I will do better. And so after about a year, year and a half of the rentals, we'd already started flipping, and I realized really quickly that I did not like flipping. I'm not design oriented. I'm very process systems oriented. And so going back and fixing a house after we'd already finished it with the DDRA request was like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. And so flipping to me was, I was either going to do one of two things. I was going to stop flipping, or we were going to start doing new build construction where I could process the hell out of that. Right. And so we decided at that point we were just going to stop flipping, or I stopped flipping. My partner kept going with a different company. And the rentals, like, I'm looking at that. I already had the lending business just getting started. And I looked at, what do I want to do in 10 years? And what is the biggest risk to that goal in 10 years? And it was the rental business, not because of money so much as the time commitment. I was chewing up a lot of time managing, you know, payments, doing all the operational stuff with the rental business. And I wasn't doing the things that I like doing, which is marketing, raising capital, structuring deals, things of that nature. And so it was that time I said, okay, I could keep going like this, but it's going to stagnate the thing that I want to do. And I'm not going to be doing as good of a job on the thing that I don't particularly like doing. And so let's talk to my partner and see if he wants to buy my half of the rental business. And so we structured that sale, and I sold him my half of the rental so that I could put all my eggs in the lending basket and move that ball forward as fast and as far as possible.
Yeah. When you were accumulating your rentals and doing flips, were you also borrowing hard money? Were you familiar with it from the borrower standpoint?
So we were borrowing some hard money. We raised about $10 million of private money over the course of those 3 years. And so in a way, we were already doing hard money, because basically we were raising capital from private money, and then we were structuring it into these lending trusts. And then those were entity that was the bank essentially on these properties. So we were the borrower and the trustee on the bank. And so we were already doing it in some very small fashion. And so I think along that way, what I realized was the two things that I was really good at and really liked doing was raising capital from investors and structuring deals. And what better business to go into if you are really good at those two things than hard money lending, where that's two of the three most important things that you can do.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. The reason I asked that question is because when we were building our portfolio, we had a lot of private capital as well. But there were a couple of years where the deal flow exceeded our capital, even our own capital, our private capital. So we did do some hard money loans. And through that process, we didn't recognize it as that much of an opportunity at the time. But what we recognized was there's a lot of unnecessary pain points from the borrower side on the dealing with these hard money lenders. And the ones we were dealing with were bigger institutional lenders, right? Mm-hmm. So it was just layers of processes, and you're to get draws, it was a 2-week process. And we were just seeing a lot of unnecessary transactional type stuff that we were making notes of, like, God, this is just a pain point that's slowing us down. It's a headache. So fast forward, when we, started lending ourselves, our first priority was to dissect all of that fat, right? All the things that were a part of the process that we felt was unnecessary. It was unnecessary to mitigate risk. It was just a lot of things. And that was our main focus, is how can we trim this down to provide a loan product that just knocks all that stuff out and still be responsible with it, right? Protect ourselves and protect our investors. And I think, it sounds like you had a similar experience, but that allowed us to bring, once we launched our fund, to bring a product to market that is unique in the sense that it eliminated a lot of the things that gave hard money lenders a bad reputation, right? And I know your product, and we'll go there now. Like, what, when you actually launched this hard money lending business, talk about some of the things that when you were designing your product that you focused on that would make ease of doing business with you different than other lenders.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the biggest thing that I realized through the whole raising capital for the rentals thing was just how much capital was out there. You live in this little microcosm where money is the scarcity and you can't, it's hard to find. And what you realize is the deal and the ability to do the structure, the knowledge to structure, that's the scarcity. There's tons of money out there. And so going into starting the hard money lending business, we went in with that ethos, like, let's structure a product. And by product right now, I'm talking about two things. A, the product for the investors, so the debt fund, and that is very investor friendly, provides them a high level of return, and that we can replicate for, years on end. And then on the back of that, to basically as the engine for that, let's structure a product for the borrowers that fills a need in the market. And so during the course of the time when we had all those rental properties, there were several times where we would have properties that have a good interest rate or they have good equity. We wanted to use the equity that was in that property to basically help us finish off a project. Project goes over budget or something, need to pull $30K out of this house in order to finish this other one off. But I don't want to do a refinance because I don't want to give it my good interest rate. I don't want to pay points. I don't want to, do all that stuff. But there wasn't really a product that I could just pull the money out, use it for a few months, and then put it back into that product, back into that house, and not take a long-term cash flow hit on it. And so as I got into the hard money lending, which we started with just double close funding for wholesalers, and then this need came up again. We had some builders and some developers that came and said, hey, got a project. I need a couple thousand or a couple hundred thousand to finish it off. I've got these other rental properties over here that are just sitting there. Can we leverage those? And the first question was, well, why don't you refinance them? Well, go back to your point about it takes 6 to 8 weeks and then the cash flow is gone for the next, 15 years. There's payoff penalties. There's all these things. They're going to be extracting everything but blood samples in order to just validate that this loan or this property was good. Can you structure something so that you can provide, use the equity, give us some money, we'll use it for a couple months, and we'll pay it right back. And so that's exactly what we did. We built a second position loan business where we don't use the subject property, the property that they're going to use the money on, as the collateral. But we look for performing assets, rental properties, raw land that we can, very conservatively put a second position lien in place there, give the borrowers capital for 6 months at a time. They pay interest so that we can keep our debt buffer there. And then at the end, they either pay it back, or what we do that's different than a lot of people, not there's a lot of people in our space, is we'll say, hey, you can pay us back, and we can either satisfy that second position lien, or we can leave it in place. We won't charge you anything for it. But the next time you need, let's say you're just pulled $100,000 loan and paid it off, next time you need 50 grand, like, we can issue that to you in 2 days because we already have the collateral already established. We just have to update the note, update the deed of trust. And so, you know, we started that when we did that first loan like that in August of 23. And then last year we did 2.7 million of loans like that. And as of last Friday, we hit the 3.4 million mark this year already.
Fantastic, man. So I want to summarize that at a high level because it's a very unique product. To your point, we ran into this when we were building our portfolio. We had a lot of equity in these rental properties because we were buying them right. We were forcing appreciation. We had good first position liens on them, but we needed to access that equity. And there were some products, but not quite the way you just described that. So let's do a quick case study because I really want people to understand what you're offering, because again, it's unique, and I want people to understand how they can tap into what they already have. So let's say I'll use the house I'm sitting in right now that I've converted to my office, but probably has a value right now of, say, $300,000. I owe $130,000 on it in first position. And let's say I'm building a spec home and I need $75,000. How can I pull $75,000 with your product out of this property? Kind of walk me through that case study.
So in that example, so you are currently sitting on, you have about 43% LTV in that property. So the way we would do that is we would loan up to, let's see, 300,000, sorry.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
We would loan.
It's just important to cover.
No, you're fine. I'm just doing math. I'm doing math over here. So we would loan up to 60% cumulative LTV. So cumulative meaning first position plus second position. Yeah. So the total debt on that property couldn't exceed $180,000. So with a $130,000 loan, then we would be able to come in. We would put a second position deed of trust or mortgage, whichever state you're in, on that property for the $50,000. If you wanted to go above 50, we'd have to bring in another piece of collateral for that. And then that $50,000 would get to go for whatever project that you're working on. Now, in a lot of cases, specifically when there's flips involved, we will also put a second or a third or something on the property that you're working on. We don't use the collateral there. What we're doing is creating a trigger. So when you go to sell that property, then we get hit and say, hey, they're selling this property. Can you get us a payoff statement? And so what we don't want is we don't want you to sell that property, because that's the exit strategy. When we look at when we underwrite these, we look at a couple things. First, what is the property they're using as collateral? That's number one. Second is the borrower themselves. Do they have a decent credit score? What does their record look like? Do they have experience? You know, there's a lot of things we look at borrower specific. And the third and really important one is, what's the exit strategy? How are they going to pay us back? It's one thing to say, oh, you can pay us monthly payments, but we're trying to get this money to go out and, you know, come back every 6 to 9 months or sooner. And so we want to know that you've got a good exit strategy, because I've turned down loans that the collateral looked good, but the equity that they were going to, or the project property, like, it looked like they were going to have to come out of pocket when they sold that. And I'm not going to do that loan because I don't want someone to be in a position where they have to come up with $10,000 just to get out of a deal, right, with me, because then my money's tied up. They're in a bad spot. The first position lender's tied up, and that's just a bad spot for everybody to be in. And so we look at all three of those things, the collateral, the borrower, and the exit strategy. So we would put those two deeds of trust in place. We would issue the funds. The funds would all come to you at closing. You would do what you need to do, pay monthly interest payments to us. And then when that property sells, then you would send us back our capital. And at that point, we would have that conversation. Do you want us to leave the second in place, or do you want us to satisfy it? If you leave the second, then whenever you want $50,000 or less, just let us know. We can issue that in a couple of days.
that piece of it, that last piece you just said is fantastic. I mean, the whole product is great, but I think it's important to stress the fact that at that point, now you've done the first payoff, and it's essentially, to some degree, a line of credit open, or, you know, it's available capital that all the underwriting has been done. You know, as long as you haven't gone and gotten another loan on that subject property or something like that. So to be able to access, in this example, that 50 grand in as soon as 2 days, that's a huge asset, or, you know, an arrow in your quiver to have. So, I think it's a fantastic product. And obviously, you are 3.4 million so far year to date, and you were at 2.7 last year. So you've done a great job in two areas, bringing a really good, unique product to market that obviously there is a demand for it, and you've done a good job filling that demand. But you've also, you don't have anything to lend unless you raise capital. And that's where you get into what you said your heart is in, and you love raising capital. That's sales in itself, and it seems like that's natural to you. So talk about, and I want to go quickly on this, because I want to get into a couple more topics, but compare the two. Has it been more difficult raising the capital or finding the loan demand?
I live my life on a teeter-totter. And so some days I have more capital, and some days I have more deals. Deals tend to flow in waves, right? You'll get nothing for a while, then all of a sudden you'll get inundated with deals. We saw a big push of new capital come in end of the year, and we saw a big push come in around beginning of April. I think that had a lot to do with when our distributions went out. So capital generally is like, how hard do I want to push our marketing to get more capital in? And then we kind of take our foot off the gas and put more money into marketing for deals in that funnel when we need more deals. And so the challenge is to make sure that you're balancing those to the point where you never fully run out of deals, or you see, hey, I think I'm going to be needing more deals come up and turn it on soon enough, so you don't have a stagnation. Because the last thing I want is to take someone's capital and then have it sit there waiting to be called for 6-10 weeks, right?
Yeah.
I like to try to keep it 3 to 4 weeks at most.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, we've ramped up and scaled quite a bit in the last 6 months. But I remember early on, you know, Kelly Garrett with Rehab Wallet, she, you know, is 10x what we are. But she said to your point, it will always be a seesaw. Like, you're always going to either be pulling hard on the marketing to find loans or pulling hard. It never balances out for more than a month, right? And so we're finding that too, as we early on, you know, it was, all right, guys, we need to spend this month deploying this capital, or all the capital's out there, we got to go raise money. And it is no question going to always be that way. Always. Now, one thing we have found is when we need to find loans to deploy capital, that is a quicker, easier lever to pull. It's more responsive. So when we go hard marketing to that and pull that lever hard, we tend to find the loans very quickly, the loan demand. But when we need capital, that's like an ongoing marketing for us, right? That has to be happening all the time, because with that, and I'd be curious to get your take on this, but a lot of our capital raising, the money flows in 6 months to a year after we planted that seed. So we got to be certain that we're always planting the seeds, right? Knowing that that harvest, back to the ag field, but that harvest is going to come sometimes a year or two down the road. So have you found that to be true as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple buckets, right? There's the investors that you currently have in your fund that add new funds to it. That comes a little faster, and it seems to be very correlated to when we send distributions out. The more money you send back to them, the more they want to send back in. And then the other piece is those people you're creating relationships with constantly. And so it's like, you know, just constantly throwing new fishing lines out there, fishing. And sometimes they nibble at it for a while before they actually bite. And then I think the other thing you probably see too is you get an investor like, oh, I'm going to kick you the minimum. It's our fund minimum is 75,000. They kick 75,000. Things go great for 6 months. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, here's $500,000. Yeah. Right. And there's this big, big jump. And so they do a lot of these testers. And so, I would say the only piece to that that may be different is when there's been instances where, hey, I've got a really good loan coming up, right? And I need capital to fill it out. I send a marketing email out to my investors saying, hey, we've got a big hole coming up. And people that have been kind of sitting back see that the need is there and they push more money in. So I can pull that lever a little bit, you know, to a certain extent on my existing network of investors, but certainly as a longer game, and it, as it should be, right? Because growing capital is a long game thing. It's not, yeah. You don't want somebody that's so brash that everything comes in, because then what happens if they find something better? All of a sudden, everything could come out really quick later on.
Yeah, we have found that exact thing to be true, and so much so that we've done that enough now. I mean, our longer term investors have been with us since the beginning, and the ones that have filtered in, they know now, like they're reaching out to us saying, hey, are you guys taking more capital now? Do y'all have the appetite for more capital without us having to really proactively go get it, which is great. That's what you want. You know, you want them to over time grow more and more confidence in what they're investing in and want to throw more and more money at it. So we're going to shift gears to kind of wrap this thing up, Lauren, because I know it's something since the podcast, when I was on your podcast, you and I have stayed connected quite a bit. But I want to talk about, you mentioned your four kids, you mentioned your wife, and we've spent the last 45 minutes barely talking about them and mostly talking about business. But I know without a doubt, they are far more important than you, and they're the reason you're doing all this business stuff. So you have been on quite a health journey over the last couple of years. And we share something in common about around workouts and just trying to be overall healthy because we want to be here longer with our family. So talk about that journey, talk about what motivated it and where you're at with your own personal health journey.
Yeah. So when around the time my second son was born, I decided I need to get myself in shape. I was about 300 pounds at that point in time. And so it was almost 10 years ago now. And basically just started working out, and for a long time was doing CrossFit on a, you know, 5 to 6 day a week basis. Then COVID hit and things kind of got all shifted around. To your point, I don't have the record you're going, but in November of 2023, I was diagnosed with kidney disease that kind of just shifted my whole paradigm around of how I thought about things. And I said, I have to stay accountable to myself. I have to set a good example for my kids. And so in December of 2023, I started working out, and I have not missed a single day since then. And we were texting back and forth, right? Because every weekend, all of April up to now, I've done a half Murph, which is a mile run, 50 pull-ups, 100 push-ups, 150 air squats, mile run every weekend, right? But the whole point isn't that I'm killing myself every day. The whole point is that I'm doing something every single day. And I do that when I wake up every day. It sets my mind into the right spot. It gets me out of bed and gets me moving. And it sets a good example for my kids because, you know, when my kids get older, you know, they're young now, 10, 8, 4, be 5 in the end of the week. And 2, you know, the 10-year-old kind of wants to work out, but they're going to see dad working out, and it'll be just something that, well, I'm an adult. I have the expectation is to keep my body healthy. And I want to be that good example, not just financially or as a father, but also physically, because I want them to have long, healthy lives.
Man, I love it. I mean, we've talked about it, but do you know who Cameron Haynes is? Okay. Do you know who Chris Williamson is? He has the...
I've heard the name, but not as familiar as I am with
you. Yeah, Chris has one of the top podcasts in the world, but he had Cam Haynes on recently, and they were talking... So Cam's got, you know, he's got two sons that are just doing phenomenal stuff. One of them just broke the world record for pull-ups in 24 hours. He runs marathons, like 2-hour, 30-minute marathons and jeans. But Chris asked Cam, he was basically saying, what makes your sons such outliers? And Cam didn't know. He was like, I mean, I was hard on them as a kid and blah, blah, blah. And Chris kind of challenged him. He said, no, what makes them that way is they watched you doing these things for all their years growing up. And you just nailed that. Our kids, your kids are seeing you do half Murphs every weekend. They're seeing you wake up early. They don't have to do it with you, but they're seeing you do these things. And then as they mature and become adults, who do they look up more to than their dad and their mom, right? And if their mom and dad, the two people that they admire the most, and they're setting an example and being a model, they're going to emulate that. They're going to do these things. And that motivates me every single day. Like, I want my kids to see me up there in the room above my garage or out in the yard running sprints saying, God, Dad's a psycho, but I love him. And I guess that's the way we got to be, you know? And I take it probably extreme sometimes with some of the little challenges I do and stuff like that. But to your point, my kids, I'd rather them see that than me being to the extreme of sitting on the couch eating ice cream every day, all day, right? And just being lazy and then down the road having health issues because of it. And you had your health issues, right, at an early age, and you know, that triggered all this. But talk about your energy and your energy to show up for your family and your business because of this commitment to be healthy.
I mean, I think so. I'll be honest. There's some days it causes me less energy because I'm exhausted, right? Because you get up. But yeah. That's not the point. The point of consistently working out is, yes, it's about the kids, but it's also about proving to yourself that you're not a liar to yourself. If I say that I'm going to, and the goal is that I'm going to work out 1,000 days in a row, right? That's the goal. When I get to 1,001, it'll probably be 2,000 or something, right? But I promised myself that, hey, I was going to do Murph all of April. I'm going to work out 1,000 days. And if I don't do that, if I miss a workout, case in point, on Saturday, we had a baseball tournament. We didn't get home. We left at 6:30 in the morning, so I didn't work out before we left. Didn't get home until 4 o'clock at night. We had something going on Sunday, so I was helping clean the house, whatever. I didn't get out the door to go for a run until about 8 o'clock at night on Saturday after getting up at 5 in the morning and being at baseball all day. Sunburns on my legs, feeling exhausted, had worked out the day before. And I went out and I said, I'm just going to run a mile and a half and be done with this. Just check the box, right? I got out there, did a mile and a half, and I said, there's no way I can look myself in the eye and know that I bitched out on this run. And so I did a full 3.5 mile run like I normally do on those long days of baseball. But it was more about proving to myself that I keep my promises. And those things translate directly into business. They translate directly into being a dad. They translate into all portions of life, because there's just times when you have to do stuff you don't want to do. Right. And if you don't do it, you know, that's a choice that has long-term implications, right? I'm choosing not to eat healthy. I'm going to get fat and lazy. I'm choosing not to do that work. I'm going to stagnate my career, stagnate my money earning potential. There are things that we have to do that we don't want to do. And building that muscle, that mental muscle to go forward and do those things you don't want to do on the exercise side of things directly relates to when I don't want to do something in my business or when I don't want to do something for my marriage, that I nut up and do it to make things better for the long term.
Yeah, I have nothing to add there, man. That was well said. I got goosebumps when you were talking about getting to the mile, and it's like, nope, I'm here. This is what I do. I'm going to do it. So I think it has become, and I don't know. I kind of turned it into a game in a lot of ways, but I have this vision of 75, 85-year-old me, right? And this vision of, it could go one of two ways. I can be there and I could be hiking with my kids, playing with them, playing with my grandkids, rolling around on the floor, or I could be sitting back in a recliner because I literally physically cannot get up because I'm overweight. I have diabetes. I have hip issues. And barring getting, you know, attacked by a bear or something like that, the things I can control, I owe it to my family and myself and everybody that I have, you know, a responsibility to be here for, to do everything I can to be that 85-year-old that's running around in the yard, physically able to and capable of doing that. And if I don't do that, I've tricked myself. I mean, and it's true. It's not a trick, but I've made myself believe if I don't commit to that and I'm not that at 85, again, barring some kind of freak accident or disease, then I've let my family down. And I don't want to do that. And I get, like, it is so impactful, that mindset, to me, that I get emotional about it and I get fired up about it. And sounds like you have a lot of those thoughts. And I love meeting, connecting, and bringing people, you know, in my bubble and in my network that have that same mindset. So I appreciate you for that. So.
Yeah, but it's a... Everybody's in the same on the same little rock spaceship flying through eternity, right? And it's how we interact with our surroundings that dictates what kind of life we have. And I choose to make the decision to make my life and my family's life as good as I possibly can through the choices I can't control.
Yep. So, Lauren, I can't thank you enough, man. I'm so glad our paths have crossed. I know without a doubt that moving forward, we will collaborate, and whether it's just pushing each other to stay healthy or we do some stuff in business together, I'm excited about it. You mentioned yesterday was your 13th anniversary, right?
Yesterday was our 13th anniversary. And date night tonight.
Date night is tonight. So I don't want to hold up or get in the way of that, but I can't thank you enough. Because I know we're going to have a lot of people listening, and I know the thing that a lot of people are going to key in on is your product that you offer. So what's the best way, and we'll drop all your links and stuff but just for folks listening that don't look at that, the best way for folks to connect with you and learn more about what you have going on.
Yeah. So the easiest way is I'm pretty active on Instagram. So it's at Invest with Lauren, LOREN. Reach out, follow me there, DM me. I also have a podcast called Brick by Brick that Jason was so cordial to be a guest on. It was a great conversation there. We talk all about different people, investors, real estate people. I just had a VC on talking about his business the other day. So really interesting stuff there. And then if you're just interested in our products from a borrower side, it's called reidoubleclose.com. And that's our business is REI Transactional.
Love it. Love every bit of it, man. Again, thank you for coming on. I was honored to be on yours, and I encourage folks to go check it out. It's a similar style podcast, for folks that have followed here. If you enjoyed this, it's a very similar style. Lauren has some great guests on, some great entrepreneurs, and he taps into mindset and all those things. So go check that out, Brick by Brick. Lauren, thank you again. Appreciate you joining me on Burning the Ships.
Thank you, man.
All right. That was wonderful, man. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Burning the Ships. I want to give a special thanks to our sponsor, 608B Capital, helping real estate investors secure fast, reliable funding to fuel their boldest moves. If you're ready to take your investing to the next level, visit 608bcapital.com to learn more. If you found value in today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast. Your feedback not only helps us improve, but it also helps us reach more people who are ready to burn the ships and commit fully to their goals. And don't forget to share the episode with someone who needs that extra push to take bold action. I'll leave you with this. Burning the ships isn't just about removing the option to retreat. It's about unlocking the courage to charge forward. No matter the odds, the past is behind you and the future is yours to conquer. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time on Burning the Ships.